We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Now with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Day, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Herbie, let's go.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Can I say something, please? This man is not asking the right questions.
Can we have some order here, please?
He's bunching us all together. Who is he to talk? Kyle's boy didn't even hit his own weight. Your Honor, if it pleases the court...
Sit down, Bucky.
Shut up! If it pleases the court, I would like to take the stand.
You'll take the stand when you're called.
What if they don't call me?
Please be seated.
Well, wait a minute now. What if they don't call me?
Be seated.
Your Honor, I want a separate trial. The fact that I never took a penny hasn't been brought up once. I had 327 in this series. I didn't make an error. I'm being charged for a conspiracy. I didn't have nothing to do with it.
John Cusack as Buck Weaver in Eight Men Out. I've read the book. I've seen the movie. Obviously, the White Sox are it's still on the schedule that the White Sox are playing at the Field of Dreams against the Yankees. They have not canceled that yet, although I don't see how in the world that game gets played. But whatever. I've always been fascinated by the 1919 White Sox, the history of it, what's real, what's fiction. And ESPN had done this E60 on the subject, which I was, like, blown away by. And I saw someone, I was like, oh, that guy seems pretty smart. I'd like to talk to him. And then the COVID pandemic happens. And I'm like, oh, what about talking with Jacob about all this? So I got back on it, reached out to him, and I'm so glad that he's here. Jacob Pomerenke is a baseball historian. He's been working on the Black Sox 100 research for Sabre. He's the author of Scandal on the South Side, and he joins me now on the Alpamonte Ford Hotline. Alpamonte Ford has 500 new and used vehicles for you to choose from out in Melrose Park. Check it out, alpamonteford.com. Jacob, thanks so much for being on with me. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on, Lawrence.
Okay, I want to ask you, because obviously a lot of people have taken what they've seen in Eight Men Out to be as gospel as anything if they're not actually doing research. So someone who has done the research, you've been to the Chicago Historical Society, you've dug and dug and dug. What's the most egregious thing about the film that bothers you?
Well, there's quite a bit, and no one expects Hollywood to be 100% accurate, of course, but you know, the issue is that Eight Men Out was written back in the 1960s, more than 50 years ago. And we've learned so much about the Black Sox scandal and the 1919 World Series since then. So, you know, we're piecing together the story in a far different way than the author of that book, Elliot Asenoff, had access to. And I'd say the biggest myth about the Black Sox scandal is this idea that they threw the World Series because the White Sox owner, Charles Comiskey, was this Scrooge character who paid them so poorly and treated them so bad that they had no choice but to throw the World Series. I think that's the biggest number one myth about the Black Sox scandal.
All right, then let's talk about salaries. How much were these guys making in comparison to what the average American was making back then?
Well, we now have access to their accurate salary records from the Baseball Hall of Fame. This is something that Eight Men Out did not have access to, and you know, we're able to kind of put together that story. And the White Sox in 1919 had one of the highest payrolls in baseball, not one of the lowest. The players were making an average of about $4,000 or $5,000 a year, which was about four times the average working man's salary in America in 1919 after World War One. And some of the Black Sox players who fixed the World Series were among the highest paid players at their position, like Eddie Seacott, the ace pitcher, and Chick Gandel and Shoeless Joe Jackson. All these players were pretty well paid compared to other players in baseball.
Do you think that these guys were duped into being involved in this? Or, I mean, some of the stuff I read tells me that Seacott and Gandel kind of went and found the gamblers to get on this.
Yeah, that's another one of the biggest myths. We published this project called the Eight Myths Out Project at Sabre last year for the 100th anniversary of the 1919 World Series. And that's one of our big eight myths that we discussed, was that the players themselves were the ones who approached the gamblers to initiate the World Series fix. It was not the other way around. These guys were not naive and undereducated ball players. They knew what they were doing, and this was part of the culture of baseball at the time. Gambling and baseball kind of were intertwined in the early 20th century. You could not go to the ballpark without being able to bet on games. Gamblers had their own sections at Fenway Park in Boston and Wrigley Field in Chicago. This was just part of the culture of the game, and ball players and gamblers mixed all the time. So these guys, you know, saw each other on road trips and were friends with some of the gamblers, and so that's kind of how it all happened.
So was this really just kind of an idea? It was convenient. This was a way to make a quick buck instead of, we're so underpaid, we have to find a way to get out from under the thumb of Charles Comiskey.
Right. You know, and there is some validity to the idea that they were underpaid, because back then there was no free agency, there was no players union. So the players didn't really have any recourse about negotiating higher salaries. And this was the days of the reserve clause, when players were tied to one team for their entire careers. So they did have a little bit of resentment, but so did every other player on all 16 major league teams. The White Sox cannot be singled out for hating their owner any more than the Philadelphia A's would hate their owner, Connie Mack. So I think this idea that the White Sox were treated so poorly, and that this is the reason that they were motivated to fix the World Series, it really isn't true. It doesn't hold up to kind of modern scrutiny with modern research.
Noted baseball historian Jacob Pomeranke joining me here on The Score. His Twitter name is @BuckWeaver. So what was it about Buck that you decided that you were going to take him on as an avatar for yourself on Twitter?
Well, it was available at the time, 10 or so years ago, and I've used Buck Weaver all over the place. And, you know, his story is so compelling. You know, this is one of the reasons why we're still talking about the Black Sox scandal more than 100 years later, is because it kind of has a little bit of everything: crime, corruption, betrayal, injustice. And I think injustice is the word that most people would use to describe Buck Weaver's story, because by all accounts, he did not get paid to fix the World Series. And he may or may not have had guilty knowledge about what was going on. I believe he did know what was going on. There is some evidence that he attended the meetings between the players, but so did everyone else. A lot of other people, including Charles Comiskey, also had guilty knowledge and tried to cover it up after the fact. So Buck's story is something that lives on, and Shoeless Joe Jackson, of course, is in the popular culture with Field of Dreams and the Eight Men Out movie. And so it's just, it's a story that lives on, and we're continuing to find out more about it. So it's a story that continues to fascinate people 100 years later.
I know that this might be a stretch to make this parallel, but at the time that the White Sox and the Reds are going to play this World Series, there's an end to a world war. There's also a nation that's recovering from a pandemic. And so here baseball is again trying to restart after dealing with a pandemic. For back then, is that why we saw the World Series go 9 games? Because was that a money grab that happened because they were trying to make up for revenue lost?
Essentially, yes. I do believe that's true. It was something that, after World War One and, of course, the global flu pandemic in 1918-1919, no one knew whether fans would return to the game in 1919. And the baseball owners made the decision to shorten the season by 2 weeks to 140-game schedule in 1919. And so, they weren't quite sure what was going to happen when baseball returned. And so that was one of the ways that they wanted to help increase interest, was to make it a best of nine series. And that experiment only lasted 3 years, 1919 to 1921, before it ended. And we went back to the best of seven ever since. But yeah, that was one of the reasons, because nobody quite knew what was going on. It has a lot of parallels to what we're facing today.
In my mind, I think of that team and go, man, this was a team that you couldn't beat. How good were they actually?
Oh, they were certainly very good, and I think on the verge of possibly a dynasty in the American League. And it would have been a lot of fun to see how they would have competed against Babe Ruth and the Yankees in the early 1920s. I think those battles for the pennant would have been really intense. You know, they had won the World Series in 1917, and the war shortened the season in 1918, and they lost a lot of players to the military and to defense industry jobs in 1918. But 1919, they had their core team back, and so you know, they ended up winning the pennant. They were a very strong team, especially the offense. The pitching kind of relied on the 1-2 punch of Eddie Seacott and Lefty Williams, because Red Faber had contracted what we think might be the flu in 1919, and he missed half the season, and he missed the World Series. He's a future Hall of Famer. But their offense was stacked, and they had a great lineup, 1-8 in the lineup, and they were a very, very good team. But so were the Cincinnati Reds, the National League champions. They should not get short shrift as deserving champions. They were a very good all-around team as well.
And don't the at least at the time, weren't the people in Cincinnati, didn't they believe that their team was actually good enough to have won this game flat out, won this series flat out?
Absolutely, and all of the Reds players and fans said so, you know, for the rest of their lives. They believed that if the World Series had been played on the level, that they would have beaten the White Sox. And I think there's a strong case to be made for that, because the Reds, unlike most teams at the time, had a strong five-man pitching rotation, and they used all five starters in the World Series. They had a very deep pitching staff, and the White Sox were reliant on their 1-2 punch of Seacott and Williams. So there is, you know, if either of those guys had faltered, it, you know, it's possible that the Reds would have won the World Series on the level. I think they were a much deeper team all around than the White Sox were. The White Sox were very reliant on their star players. So, yeah, no, I think the Reds have a strong case that they could have won the World Series on the level.
Talking with Jacob Pomeranke, who is the author of Scandal on the South Side, noted baseball historian, a member of Sabre. He does a tremendous job, and I'm glad he's got a few minutes to kind of hang out and talk with us about the 1919 White Sox. What was Kennesaw Mountain Landis's connection to baseball? Because in the book and in the movie, it almost makes it seem like he's this outsider that they brought in. But wasn't he connected to the league before that?
He was. He was actually a federal judge based in Chicago. And his claim to fame in terms of baseball relations before the Black Sox scandal is that he was the judge who oversaw the Federal League's lawsuit against Major League Baseball. And they were trying to sue Major League Baseball to become a third major league in 1914-1915. And so Landis was the judge who oversaw that case, and he essentially helped Major League Baseball win that case by waiting it out so that the Federal League ran out of money and had to fold, essentially. So Landis had helped Major League Baseball a few years earlier, and he was a noted baseball fan. You could find him at the ballpark all the time. So when baseball was trying to come up with a new leadership structure with a one-man commissioner, Kennesaw Mountain Landis was an ideal choice to serve as, you know, as commissioner and in the best interest of the game. So that's why he got the job.
What happened to Shoeless Joe afterwards, and why was he depicted as a rube, considering that he had a lot of businesses that succeeded?
Yeah, you know, Shoeless Joe Jackson is a fascinating, complex person. You know, he was illiterate. That is true. He could not read or write, never could. You know, he famously stopped going to school around the age of 8 or 9 so that he could work in the textile mills in South Carolina. So all of that is true, and I think that's kind of built up into this legend that Shoeless Joe was this dumb ball player, and all he could do was hit a baseball better than just about anyone on the planet. And that was also true. But no, he was a very shrewd businessman, too. He was very successful after baseball, after he was banned for life. and running various businesses with his wife, Katie. And so, you know, so this idea that, again, Shoeless Joe is kind of this archetype of this dumb ball player that got caught up in a scandal that he knew nothing about, unfortunately doesn't hold up with what we know about him. His story is much more complex and much more fascinating, I think, than even the legend gives him credit for.
So what do you believe, after digging into all of this stuff, what do you buy about how this went down and how it's portrayed?
Well, I think this was certainly a black eye for baseball, and nobody really comes out of this story looking good. This was a situation, like I said, the culture of baseball at the time was that gambling was rampant, and you know, nobody was really overseeing it. Nobody in baseball, nobody outside of baseball. It was something that I think was inevitable. It was a perfect storm that the gamblers and the ball players were going to get together and fix games, because no one had ever really been punished for it. I think the Black Sox scandal happened because the players saw such a low risk of punishment and such a high reward. They were going to make as much as their annual salaries in 1 week for fixing that World Series. And they didn't think anyone was going to punish them for it, because no one had ever really been punished for fixing games before. And so I think that was one of the reasons this whole thing happened, is because baseball had a lot of opportunities to clean up the gambling culture and the game fixing in the 1910s before the 1919 World Series. And in that way, it's very similar to kind of what we're seeing now with the Houston Astros and the sign stealing and technology. Baseball had a lot of opportunities to clean this up and kind of lay down the iron fist and say, you know, we're not going to tolerate this anymore. And that was true 100 years ago with gambling as well. And I think that's, you know, one of the parallels here, is that baseball could have cleaned this up a long time before 1919. And they always chose to look the other way in the name of profits. And I think that's one of the reasons this whole thing boiled up and became a huge scandal like it did.
There's nothing better when you're digging through things and you find something that you think is super relevant. And I know that a lot of historians in a lot of different disciplines have that moment. For you, what was the moment where you're digging through, probably even wearing gloves, looking at stuff, and you went, wow, what was it about in researching this that made you take a step back?
Well, one of my biggest interests is kind of what happened to these guys off the field after they were banned for life. And there's that famous scene in the movie Eight Men Out at the very, very end. And Shoeless Joe Jackson is playing outlaw baseball in New Jersey in 1925 or so. And supposedly Buck Weaver, played by John Cusack, is in the stands for this game. And when I saw that movie for the first time, I wanted to know, did this really happen? Was Shoeless Joe Jackson playing ball under an assumed name in New Jersey, and Buck Weaver was watching him play? Well, that part isn't true. Buck was never there. But Shoeless Joe did play in New Jersey, and he played all over the place, and so did all these other guys. And so being able to dig up some of those stories, these guys fanned out all across the country, all across North America, played into Canada and into Mexico too, to play baseball in the 1920s and all the way into the late 1930s, because that's what they did. That's how they made a living. They played baseball in the summer. And so being able to dig up some of those stories that have never been told before in some cases has always fascinated me. And you know, one of the inspirations that continues to drive me to keep digging into this story, because we're still learning more about these guys. We're still learning more about the scandal and what happened back in 1919. And that's, you know, one of the reasons this story still fascinates me.
Do you, the Black Sox 100 Project, are you guys going to, because we're coming up on what, the anniversary of the trial, aren't we?
That's right. The grand jury hearings and the famous confession, the Say It Ain't So story, which did not happen, unfortunately. You know, all that was in September of 1920. So the 100th anniversary of that will be coming up later this year. And the criminal trial was in 1921. So we're going to stretch this 100th anniversary thing out for about 3 years.
I think that's good. I like to learning all of this stuff, which is great. As a baseball fan, someone who loves the game, What do you think, what makes sense as far as a 2020 season working for you?
Well, you know, I think the main thing is we just have to make sure that everyone's going to be safe. I think that's the biggest issue, is the health and safety of not only the players, but everybody who's involved in putting on a baseball game and a baseball season. I think that's something that, you know, there's a lot of logistics to be worked out. And so it'll be interesting to see if Major League Baseball and the players union can work it out, but also, you know, working with public health officials too. And this was something they dealt with the flu pandemic in 1918-1919 as well. So history doesn't always repeat itself, but it often rhymes, I think, as the old adage goes. So, you know, it'll be interesting. I like everyone else, I sure hope baseball will come back, but there's a lot of other factors that have to be satisfied as well.
Over the winter, I was in Arizona when the Society for American Baseball Research did an event in Phoenix. It was the Phoenix chapter, and they had done an event in Scottsdale, and it was a whole day of, like, baseball history, and I absolutely loved it. I highly recommend, if there's ever a Sabre event, and you can just follow Sabre at Sabre, S-A-B-R, on Twitter, that you go. For someone like you, when you're getting ready to present in a room like this with other baseball historians and other fans, what are the things that you try to get across when you're telling the best stories of the game?
Well, you know, I think the number one thing is to tell a good story, an interesting story. I think, you know, baseball is just chock full of interesting facts and figures about all sorts of players. And it's not always the most famous players who have the best stories. And I think that's one thing that Sabre has done so well over the last 50 years as an organization, is tell the stories that a lot of people don't realize, you know, the Moonlight Grahams of the world. You know, those guys have fascinating life stories, not just on the baseball field, but off the field too. And the Baseball Biography Project that Sabre does is wonderful in terms of telling people stories that, you know, don't always see the attention in the light of day that, you know, the big stars, the Babe Ruths and the Jackie Robinsons of the world do. So it's always fun to learn about stories, and Sabre is a great organization for learning something new about baseball. I learn something new from our members every single day about some aspect of baseball.
A texter, before I let you go, Jacob, a texter says you're amazing and asked you about sports movies. I'm going to try and filter the question a little bit. As someone who believes in getting empirical proof on things, is there a Hollywood sports movie that you really like and think that does do an accurate job of portraying the event?
That's a very good question. I think there are movies that get the spirit of it right. I think Bull Durham has held up very well in terms of capturing the spirit of the minor leagues. Now, whether or not all those stories and all those anecdotes happen, you know, I think can be left up to the imagination. And I think Eight Men Out in many ways does capture the imagination and kind of the zeitgeist of the time with gambling and baseball. The problem is it relies on source material that, you know, we've flipped on its head. The central thesis of Eight Men Out is wrong. So, you know, and I think, but there's a lot of stories. I think, you know, the Moneyball film that came out about 10 years ago is a terrific look at, you know, what was going on in baseball in the early 21st century. But, you know, again, you can quibble over some of the historical details, and certainly all of us in Sabre will do that. But no, there's a number of movies, I think, that get it right on kind of the grand scheme of things.
Jacob, I appreciate your time. This was a really, really fascinating interview, and I appreciate you jumping on. Your book, Scandal on the South Side, you should be following Jacob. Very simple to follow him on Twitter, at Buck Weaver is how you can follow him on Twitter. So if you remember nothing else, remember that that's his handle on Twitter. Thanks so much for spending some time with the Chicago audience.
Thanks for having me on, Mark.
That's Jacob Pomeranke. That was great! Oh, I love that. I love that type of stuff. Someone asked, can we do more stuff like that? Well, yeah, we can. It's just a matter of trying to find, like, what will suit your fancy. Trust me, I'm dying to have my friend Shakia Taylor on the show to talk about Effa Manley, because she wrote a piece about Effa Manley that left my mouth open. And I was just like, huh? Shoot, I should get Bob Kendrick on the phone and talk about the Negro Leagues, too, while we're at it. Let's just do a whole thing of baseball history on this show. But that was awesome. I'm glad that he's doing a little fact versus fiction when it comes to the Black Sox. And he's right. They are going to stretch out their research over the 100 years because the trial starts in 21. So there's plenty of stuff. There's a lot of things that they can still do on this. So he's a great follow. Shout out to my man Christopher Komka too. If you're someone who digs on history of the game and statistical history of the game, you should be following him on the twitters.com. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I do want to get back into some of the conversation about restarts in baseball and other sports. I'll explain more next after this on The Score.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2 on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
I think that we can find some time, since we're doing all this historical stuff for the Bulls, I think we can find some time to delve into some other historical issues in sports, specifically baseball. It's got a pretty long history. We could find some things and do some stuff. I'm glad that for those of you that enjoyed it, you enjoyed it. Because those are the types of things I really like doing. And I guess this is, until we get games back, I was talking with Mitch Rosen today, me and he were texting, and I feel like for sports, understand what I'm saying, specifically sports, if we use the analogy of flattening the curve, for sports, I think that we're on the downside of the curve because things are starting to come back now, or at least planning to come back. The UFC had an event, which I will get to momentarily. You have golf planning its season out, and it's going to get underway in June. You have baseball and basketball starting to talk about how to make this all make sense. And I think that we're headed, the sports industry in particular, is headed back to is into the new normal. I don't know if all this stuff is going to stick or whether or not it can even be pulled off. But I think that's where we stand right now, which brings me to Steve Stone. Steve Stone was on this morning, and, you know, any time that I can get Steve Stone's perspective, I'm all about getting his perspective. But take a listen to what he had to say about the challenges of starting back up.
Well, I think you should be more excited than you would have been a few weeks ago. I think because of the owner's proposal to the Players Association, there is a roadmap back to actually playing what will be left of this season. And if you believe a whole lot of people who are speculating, the proposal is for 82 games, and it's going to expand the playoffs. There's going to be another four teams in the playoffs, which means that these games, which are normally during this season consequential games, are going to be more consequential because there's only going to be 82 of them, and then you head off to the playoffs where, you know, four more cities will have something to play for late. I think the games, because of the condensed nature of what they're forced to do, the games are going to have more meaning. They're going to be more important, and managers are going to have to manage accordingly because, you know, you guys know every year we talk about the fact that this is a marathon, not a sprint. Well, you can throw that out because now it's pretty much a sprint. If that's a full-out sprint for 82, you want to get off to a pretty good start. And I think because there's more teams going to be involved in the playoffs, I think it's going to be more exciting for the fans of those cities that in other years wouldn't be there. Plus, we're going to see a whole different kind of game. I mean, nobody knows exactly what it looks like, but the speculation is there's going to be a designated hitter to be employed by both leagues. And there's going to be a lot more guys on your roster. There's going to have to be a taxi squad. So baseball is trying to improvise as well as they possibly can. And most people, and not all people, because I have a lot of followers on Twitter, and some of them say, well, I'm not going to come back and watch what's going to be a season with an asterisk to it. And what I tell them is you're going to be in a very small minority because I think most of the people just want to see the game back on the air.
So, Steve, what we do know about the owners is they're proposing a 50-50 revenue split. And the players obviously want to avoid anything that resembles a salary cap. How careful do both sides have to be that they don't create optics that are unseemly in the midst of a pandemic and you have billionaires fighting with millionaires? Because that's something no baseball fan really wants to see.
Well, I think that if both sides realize that this is a one-term negotiation, you know, the collective bargaining agreement is coming up. And if you can make a stipulation that regardless of what happens here, it's not carried over to the collective bargaining agreement. I think both sides can understand that these are extraordinary circumstances, hopefully never to be duplicated. And I can't speak for either side, but I realize that we're in uncharted territory here. So I don't think that anything they agree to right now is going to be something that's going to bind them in the next collective bargaining agreement. So if they can just treat this as a one-off kind of deal, making the concessions they have to make on both sides, I think perhaps the collective bargaining agreement can go a little more smoothly. But if they're going to use this, if either side is going to use this as a roadmap to what happens in the next negotiation, I don't think it's going to end well.
I don't either. There is one thing, though. There's one thing that I feel like baseball is kind of trying to slide in there and say, oh, yeah, we're only doing this because, you know, pandemic. And that's the universal DH. For the last couple of years, we have heard baseball talk about, oh, well, maybe we will make it a universal thing that you'll have the DH in the National League. And this gives them the opportunity to just go, remember how we did that whole thing with the universal DH? Well, we really liked it, so we're just going to keep doing it. I know some people are against it. I am not. I'm someone who loves the game, but I am tired of seeing pitchers hit because most of them can't. Some of them can. Madison Bumgarner, Jake Arrieta, there's some guys who can rake, but I've had enough. I don't need to see that anymore. Just make the game cleaner and easier to manage for sure. And then you could just make them all one league. That'll never happen. Well, maybe it'll happen. Herbie, you got into fights with people on Twitter about the universal DH last night, didn't you?
I mean, I always do because traditionalists are dumb. This game is meant to evolve, and if you like seeing people who could not do their job, enjoy yourselves.
Well, it's strategy. I love the double switch. It's not that hard. It's literally not that hard.
I do it every time on MLB The Show. I'm like, this is just dumb. Why am I changing this pitcher to put in a guy that made the last out and take him out of the game and put the pitcher spot there? Goodness gracious. It's so easy. I mean, if you look up the stats, back in the 70s when pitchers were hitting well, maybe you had an argument. But pitchers nowadays are terrible at hitting. And the people that people, you know, put that caveat, he's a good hitting pitcher, they're not good hitters. They're terrible hitters. They're just good hitters for pitchers. It's like the backhanded compliment. Like, if you look at Madison Bumgarner's stats, you'll be surprised how bad it is.
Was he hit like 175 or something like that?
Yeah. He's not good. He's just good for a pitcher. And then this guy's like, oh, he only does it 5 days a week. Exactly. He's a specialist. Let him
be the
specialist.
Wow, I was on the money, man. I was on the money with that. He hits 177.
Yeah, he's a specialist.
He's a 532 OPS, which means he's worse than Daniel Descalso.
And think about that. The people always say, well, if you're going to hit, you got to play the field. Like, well, why would you want to do that? You don't make the starting pitcher pitch every day. Why you make this guy who is a specialist? He's the only one that does that thing that he does that day, start the game. So why would you make him go and do something else? You don't make the kicker also be the quarterback or the punter be the something else. Those guys are specialists. They sit on the side and they do their job. And when they're called upon, they go and sit down otherwise.
Unless it's Tom Tupa.
Yeah. And that's a special situation. That was great for what it was, a one-off. But imagine if the punter or the kicker had to be a quarterback. Is there an emergency quarterback and he had to be the quarterback every once in a while? That would suck.
I just think that it's going to be a real slick way for baseball to just go, oh, yeah, we're just going to keep that DH thing.
And all the people who call me a moron, please explain to me why being a pitcher and making that guy hit is a good thing other than tradition. Please. One good argument. I'll wait.
He will wait. If you wanted to call and give the argument, because doing it by text is not great, 312-644-6767. And he's right. The only real argument is it's the way that we've always done it. Like, that's it.
Like that's all we have is if you're someone who's going to – it's the way we've always done it. So why wouldn't we – even though a majority of the games now, considering that there's interleague and American League games, are with a designated hitter. So why not just do it universally? And I feel like that's exactly what they're going to do. Just kind of slide it under the door into the next CBA. And the byproduct of that is you would have more jobs for the players. There are more players that would end up sticking around. They're going to expand the rosters to 30, and they're going to try to figure a lot of this stuff out. That I do have some concerns about it. Here's a piece of sound that I wanted to share with you. So my buddy Dave Ross, who – not that David Ross. Dave Ross, who works at Stadium Network, he covers MMA. But we were having a conversation about how UFC had their event 249 this past weekend. And the NASCAR people got really mad because they didn't say NASCAR was coming back this week. NASCAR is coming back this week for their first race. NASCAR has to come back because they're in a world of hurt. But there's an opportunity here for NASCAR. Let's see if they can capture some people. Anyway, I asked Dave about UFC being the canary in the coal mine for the rest of sports, and here's what he said.
I like the way that Dana laid out a strategy, and he was not foolish enough to think that it would be without peril and it would be without somebody testing positive. In the weirdest sense of it, Lawrence, I think the best thing to come out of this, and I feel bad for Jacques Array for being the guy that did test positive, but sports has to know that there is inherent risk when you go back to the business of whatever sport you're in. There is going to be no way to safeguard the sports world. And by that, it's not just the athletes. Remember, two other people in Jacques Array's corner also tested positive on Friday night before Saturday's event. So they had a plan in place. So we're going to quarantine Jacques Array. We're going to quarantine the other two people that tested positive and keep those fighters separate from the others. And we're going to test after the events are over. And then we're going to go through, as they've said, and do everything they need to do for Jacques Array and the two corner men to be able to hopefully recover from this the best way possible, knowing that maybe their sport and whatever sport we go into is the reason why they were exposed to it. We don't know that to be true, but we do know that they tested positive. So I think what Dana is trying to do in the most humane way possible is say we can get our sport back in business knowing that we are going to have people test positive, and then what do we do? They had a plan after knowing that something like this was bound to happen.
So this morning I was reading Woj's story about the NBA and them getting back to them starting to talk about getting back to playing. And one of the things that Silver said is, at least for now, that one positive test isn't necessarily going to shut down the league. And I think that's a lesson that the NBA will try and take from what happened with UFC 249 this past weekend. They can't take that lesson fully until we know if more people were infected and if the UFC is going to be honest about the infections. Now, before the fight, clearly, if you have one of the participants that tests positive, you couldn't keep that from everyone. I want to know over the next 2 weeks. And if I'm the NBA, I want to know over the next 2 weeks how many more people were infected, what ended up happening to the people that were infected, and how long was that chain of infections? Those are the types of things that they're going to have to figure out. Herbie, did anyone call to give you a good argument against the DH?
No.
Then it's settled then. I think you won that argument, sir.
I mean, tradition is the only thing that people say. And then there's one guy says, whoever bats has to play the field. As I said, the counter is, you're making these specialists do something that they're not good at. Let these specialists play the field or pitch every day. If you think a guy that has to hit has to play the field, they're different people. This is why Stoney says we need a month to work up. If they weren't specialists, we wouldn't need a month. We'd like 2 weeks for hitters to get ready. If these guys needed their arms to get ready, I mean, if they didn't need their arms to get ready, we would be playing baseball already, right?
Well, I don't know about already. It wouldn't be
from June till July that we got to ramp up, right?
Right.
Baseball players and hitters are ready to go pretty much 2 weeks in.
You have to give the pitchers some time so that they – that is one of the things that I'm worried about. Like, how quickly do we get guys back? And I'm not even talking about the pandemic. I'm talking about arm injuries. How many of those do we see when you're going into, as Stoney said, a sprint versus a marathon? How far do you let starting pitchers go in half a season at the beginning of it? How many of these guys have been able to even work? Now, I know that some have. When we talked with Jason Hayward a couple weeks ago, the Cubs players have been in different small groups, been using the facilities out there in Arizona. But it's not the same as what we see every February and March. They're going to have to redo all of that stuff for the most part. Take a break, tell you a little bit about what McNeil and Parkins are doing on their show, because I got the cute picture of Shep's little baby, along with the promo sheet, which is great. Discuss that next here on The Score.
Former 90s Chicago Bull Scott Burrell talked Last Dance with Mully and Haw.
You think that there will be some people that this turns off to Michael Jordan and those tactics?
That's another great question. You guys are good today. You guys are really, really good today. I do think it turns off some people. He had to be that way because he knew he was the best. They weren't coming to beat the Bulls. They were coming to beat Jordan.
Hear the entire Scott Burrell interview with Mully and Haw at 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
Lawrence Holmes, noon to 2, on Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, a radio.com sports station.
Tech Zone is brought to you by Rosen Hyundai in Algonquin. Go get your Hyundai service there. A texter was asking about the shortened season of the NHL and how much they enjoyed it. 2013 for the NHL, right? And then 2011-2012 for the NBA. I'm with you. I thought those were great. I'm a proponent of there being less baseball, and I know that that makes me an enemy of some. I would be willing to, with those who want 162, I would be willing to go 150 with you. I personally want 100. I think 100 games is good enough. But I'd be okay if they went back to 154 or to 150 in a season. But yeah, the 2011-2012 NBA season was amazing. And the same thing for the 2013 NHL season. Bring it on, man. Bring on games every night, every game mattering. That's going to be if baseball is able to work through some of its issues, that could be the great byproduct for us, the fan. Even though we're not going to be in the building, that you could have 3 months or 4 months of great, exciting baseball where almost anyone has a chance. I brought the example of the Washington Nationals. The Washington Nationals, even in this scenario, they'd probably be out of it because they started off the season last year 19-31 in their first 50 games. But it leaves the door open with the expanded playoffs of anyone winning. And that's good. Right? For considering our situation as a baseball nation. Coming up on the McNeil and Parkins show, Dan Bernstein is going to stop by at 2:25. Nick Wright's going to be on the show at 4 o'clock. And Steve Sciarippa. Nice. That'll be at 3. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your support of us doing a little bit of history stuff on the show. Turns out we're going to do a little bit more of it, from what Herbie tells me. But I appreciate your support. Thanks for all of you who listen to The Score and stay with us. It really means a lot to all of us. Real talk. McNeil and Parkins are coming up next. I'll see you tomorrow at noon here on The Score.
Bye-bye.
Oh, you tripping. I'm out of here anyway. Peace out.
NFL football fans, let The Score hook you up while you're keeping safe at home as we air NFL Classics featuring some of the biggest games in NFL history starting tomorrow night at 7.
Join us for the NFC Championship game from January 18th, 2015. The Packers versus the Seahawks.
Here's Lynch.
Starting tomorrow night at 7 on Sports Radio 670 The Score. Chicago Sports Station, a production of Westwood One Sports.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.